you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is a podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Oliver Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital and DVD. And Amazon Prime, too.
And Tubi.
And Tubi. Can't forget Tubi.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in development on a bunch, but I'm in pre-production on my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 160 with Howard Franklin about his long career in Hollywood as a writer and director. I thought he was a good match for Adam because Adam also wrote many features before directing his first feature, just like Howard. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/mmihpodcast. That's how the show will survive and keep on going and moving forward. And also make sure to rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts. That also helps the show almost just as much. So please check that out. But without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Howard Franklin. This week, we have a very special guest, Howard Franklin. He's got 9 writing credits, including Name of the Rose, Quick Change, and The Big Year. And he's also directed several movies that starred Bill Murray, one of the best actors ever, basically.
He is. Bill Murray is amazing.
So when I was a kid, I watched a bunch of Bill Murray movies in the theater when he was coming out with movies all the time. And one of them was The Man Who Knew Too Little. I saw that in Berkeley, which is one of Howard's writing credits. And then I think Larger Than Life is the other one, the one that you directed. And well, I also saw that in the theater. Is that right?
Quick Change. I directed Quick Change with Bill.
Quick Change. Not Larger Than Life.
Yeah, that too.
That too. Okay. Yeah.
But I didn't write that.
You didn't write that. Yeah. But I actually just watched Quick Change last night. I never heard of it before.
Oh, wow. And
then Timothy had sent me an article about it saying the 25-year anniversary of the movie or whatever. And then I read the synopsis. So I was like, oh, my God, how have I not seen this movie? This is amazing. Bank robbery with clowns, Gina Davis, Bill Murray. I'm like, oh, man. So I watched it last night and I thought it was great. So.
Yeah, it's caught on with the years. It's in the AV Club cult canon.
Oh, is it?
Which I consider it. High honor.
That's what I love about movies. Is like, even if you have a movie that comes out that people didn't see, still over time it could like gain traction and find an audience.
Yeah.
It came. And those are actually usually the best movies.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing I really like about it too is that it's a very different type of movie than the kind of movies that you see today, and especially the type of bank robbery movies, you know. And then you have, is it James Robards or Jason Robards?
Jason Robards
as like the hard-boiled detective guy, and he's like a classic amazing actor from you know, classic Hollywood, I guess you'd say. So I think it was a really cool blend.
Couple of Oscars, All the President's Men, and I think Julia.
So yeah, anyways, welcome to the show, Howard. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here.
So before we get into all the questions that we have, because we all have a million questions, just give us your 1-minute bio of who you are and what your background is.
Well, I've been writing and or directing movies for over 30 years, and which is amazing because I'm only 39. And
nice.
Yeah. I went to Berkeley, actually. So there you go. Berkeley's come up twice already. And
where'd you grow up?
You're in L.A., and I never expected to stay here. I moved to, well, first I went to Berkeley, then I moved to New York. But when I fell into the movie business, this was the place to be. So I came home.
How did you fall into the movie business?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer and always have written since, you know, like age 13 or something. And I was working on novels and I wrote a script, and the script thing just happened much faster. In terms of employment and acceptance. And then I, you know, I'd always loved movies, and I wondered why I hadn't thought of that first. So I guess that's falling into it in a way.
Do you still tinker with novels at all?
It's funny you should ask. I am writing one now.
Oh, okay. You're back to it.
It's very labor intensive, and I just sold a pilot, so I keep walking away from it. That's what happens. but I'm determined to finish it. I really like it a lot. So, and I enjoy the process because unlike when you're writing a script, what you're dealing with is the finished product. You know, the words are what counts, and that's great for a writer as opposed to hoping someday this is interpreted by me or somebody else. This is the actual thing. So that's a great feeling.
Yeah. And I also, I've been kind of writing in novel format recently, and it's been fun to take a break from just the screenwriting approach. Cause with screenwriting, it's so surface, cause it's all like what you see. But when you get into kind of like writing what the characters are thinking and feeling, it's a very different experience. And you can even like throw in smells in there.
Yeah, you know, that's the key difference, smell, between fiction and movies. The thing is, it's a lot more labor intensive. That's what I'm finding. You know, you can write a script in a relatively short time, but this book thing takes a long time, at least for me.
Right. Well, like a script's what, like 18,000 words or something?
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, I think it's like 18,000 words, and an average novel is like 60,000. So it's at least like three times as much work.
Yeah.
How do you go from like wanting to write novels to writing your first screenplay?
Well, it's funny when you speak at writing courses at schools, that's where there's a Q&A and people pretend to ask kind of aesthetic questions, and then they get to, well, how did you get the first break kind of thing?
Yeah, what's the first break like?
Well, I had a novel, and somebody I knew from Berkeley, actually, I was here in LA, had seats at the Hollywood Bowl, and he invited me, and one of the other guests in the box was a Hollywood agent, and she asked to see the novel, and she said, you know, I don't really deal in novels, but I can see you could write. If you could turn this into a script, I bet I could sell it. And that's kind of what happened.
Oh, wow. That's not a story you hear too often.
No, I remember when I was at Berkeley, I took a writing class, and there was a very eminent book publisher named Billy Abrams, who was very erudite. And when they turned it over to the Q&A and people got to, how do you get published? One of the kids said, you know, it's very frustrating because you can't get to a publisher unless you have an agent, and you can't get an agent unless you've been published.
Right.
And you can't get an agent unless you know somebody. And he said in this very grand way that he said, well, do you know anybody? And the kid said, no, I don't know anybody. And he said, well, meet somebody. Anyway, so that was his advice.
Yeah, it's funny.
Meet somebody.
But I think there's some truth to that, too. I mean, I guess among the skills you need in anything as competitive and kind of full of shit as the movie business is some networking skills.
Yeah, right.
It's hard just to be such a great writer or director or whatever it is that you don't have to put yourself out there in some way.
I know, that's my problem. I'm so amazing and I'm so talented, but I just don't know anybody.
You're right. Well,
I'm just kidding. It's like the opposite.
Yeah. Well, Timothy knows what a lot of people. He doesn't really just, you know, obviously.
He won't share them with you.
Right, exactly.
So did that first screenplay that you wrote get produced?
It did not, but as a writing sample, it got me a ton of work. And that was when there was such a thing as studio work. Now they don't really develop the way they used to, but that is a huge change in terms of people trying to make a living as screenwriters now. There used to be, the first time I was ever interviewed, it was for a Time magazine article. And the subject of the article was people who were making a very good living in Hollywood over a period of months or years, or even a decade in some cases, you know, like six-figure income, whatever, and had never had a produced a script.
Right.
Where, you know, everybody knew that they had the talent and it was just a matter of time, but it just hadn't quite come together. And I was on the lower end of the scale in terms of I'd been here like, you know, 2 years or something. But and if you were, I know a lot of the people on who were interviewed in there went on to have a lot of produced things, but the ratio of development to production then was vast, which was good in one way because there was a lot of work available, but it was very frustrating in another way.
So when you first got started, it was the studios were paying writers to kind of develop material, like generate it. And then sometimes it would get produced, but a lot of times it wasn't getting produced.
Exactly.
And then did it change in the 90s, I think, was kind of like the big spec era where like then they were just buying spec scripts and not developing things the same way?
I think that the biggest, the sort of sea change came, I can't remember what year it was. I'm going to say like 2008, maybe, when they had that last strike, the writer's strike. And they kind of wiped the slate clean of development at that point, and it never came back.
Oh, wow.
But also that has a lot to do with the types of movies that studios make. You know, original screenplay market, you know, not an adaptation of a TV show or a comic book or whatever, that market is now totally, almost totally taken up by indie movies.
Right.
And in the case of indie movies, you're not getting paid to write that script. I mean, you're writing that script, you're putting it together, you're getting it independently financed. And then, of course, the studios will release it once they see it at Sundance or whatever. But it's just so much more speculative at that point. But that's why all the really great original material now is indie stuff. So
I was kind of thinking the other day about how crazy it is that, yeah, especially on the independent film level, we invest all this money in anticipation of being able to sell it later. It's like, how many other businesses are run that way?
Yeah.
Where it's like all the investments up front and you just like, you stand to lose it all if you can't find somebody to buy it later, to see it later.
And sometimes even if you can, in a way, I mean, even the ones that get released, it's terrifying. I mean, you know, the New York Times has a policy, I don't know if you know this, that any movie that opens in the five boroughs is reviewed by the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And they've had that policy forever. So, but that's why on a Friday, if you look at the arts and leisure section where they have the movie reviews, they'll sometimes be like 15 movies reviewed. And most of them are indies.
Yeah.
And they all have kind of recognizable actors and stuff like that's how they got financed. But it's like if a tree fell in the forest. I mean, they come and go so quickly. And it's just, there's so many venues now that are if you had said, you know, like 20 years ago, somebody would say, oh my God, you haven't read War and Peace. They could kind of shame you. Who would think that now you can be shamed for what? You never saw The Wire? You know, that you didn't watch a TV show? That would be a sign of your cultural ignorance. Anyway, just trying to keep up with everything, you know.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Things have changed a lot. So how do you, I want to go back at some point and talk about like the beginning of your career, but just since we're kind of in today's landscape now.
Yeah, the last thing I was going to say is about 3 years ago, my lawyer took me to lunch and he said, look, this is nothing personal. I'm saying this to all my feature writing clients. It's time to start thinking about writing pilots because there's really no more industry of hiring screenwriters.
Wow.
And my agent, when I recounted the lunch, said, yeah, that's true. And I'm going to tell you what you should do. Go to your computer and wherever you keep ideas for movies or whatever, go through there and I bet you will find a movie idea you've had sometime in the last 10 years that you thought to yourself, wow, I could have sold this in the old days. It's really a shame. And that will be your first TV show. And I found it in 6 minutes. You know, it was just the kind of movie you used to pitch as the kind of script you used to pitch as a movie now would be, a Netflix show or something like that.
Right. And is the idea that you write this pilot on spec and then sell it to one of these new networks?
Well, I've done it. That particular one was where I pitched and sold. They will still pay you the way that, you know, the movie studios do. And I'm now into my, this is the third pilot I've sold, but the second one was made, the pilot was made, and it was ABC Studios, ABC Network. It was about a very high-functioning, imperious, agoraphobic, who it's sort of a Fawlty Towers farcical thing. And we had Craig Ferguson. He was very good. And I thought it was a great pilot, but it did not get picked to go on the air. And that's a weird experience because if you're in the movie business, as one of you said earlier, like any movie, even if you had the most dismal bomb in the world, it exists. And so, you know, somewhere 10 years down the line, you'll get an email from somebody saying, oh, wow, I saw it on TV last night. I loved it.
Right.
So with this pilot thing, you know, you write it, you prep it, you cast it, you shoot it. And, you know, the movie business, if you get to the first day of principal photography, you know that thing will exist. And then with the pilot thing, it's a lot of activity. And then you get told, oh, yeah, you're not being picked up to series. And I said it was like somebody who's been in a coma for a long time comes out of the coma and everybody's tremendously excited and then lapses back into the coma. You know, it's so that's the problem with TV. But
yeah, so
at least there's a lot of activity. I like it. I like the pace of it and, you know, all that stuff.
So where does that live now? So if that died as a series, does that just like go on a shelf at the studio and it's there for like history that somebody has to go like dig it up, unearth it one day?
Yeah, I don't, you know, they... I would be happy. You know, there's some website that they have lost pilots, and there's like that great one that Conan O'Brien and Robert Smigel did about a detective, the great lost pilots. And there's another one with Jack Black doing the voice of a motorcycle.
Yeah, I saw that one.
But there's a lot of great ones. I you know, who even knows if the best ones get on the air. So there it is.
So you're saying that to make money as a writer in today's landscape, you have to be working in TV.
I would say, yeah, unless you're one of a very, you know, if there are a fortunate handful of screenwriters who, you know, but it's kind of what's become of the whole country. It's like rich and poor now. The middle class has sort of been wiped out, you know.
So what does that mean for people like us who are like on the outside? We're independent filmmakers, but we dream of being in the studio system. If we want to be writers in the studio system, is there any hope for us? Like what would be our path to get there? At this point,
I'd say if you were very adroit at animation writing, they seem to have people on staff and stuff.
Yeah, we just talked to an independent filmmaker in San Francisco whose film played at South by Southwest, and he's working at Pixar writing for them right now.
Exactly. A lot of this I just know from actually being on the picket line that last time. But there were people who were on staff for Pixar. It was almost like the old days of being on staff for MGM or something like that. And obviously, if you're great at comic book adaptation, there's a lot of employment at this point. I mean, it practically rules the studios. I'm trying to think, you know, short of that, you've really just got to, you know, I mean, I don't know that much about it because I'm not in the position of somebody starting out right now, but one of my oldest friends is Stuart Kornfeld, who's a producer who's done a million things. And he was speaking at AFI, and he said something to the effect that this was a terrible time to be starting out in the movie business.
Oh, no.
The kids said, "What are you talking about?" Right. You know, you can make a movie on your phone. You can, you can edit it on your computer. You can post it on YouTube. Anybody can be a filmmaker now. It's the freest, the best time.
Right. Anyone can be a filmmaker.
And he said, okay, let me rephrase it. Now is the worst time to try and make a living in the movie business. So, that dichotomy is really interesting. It is a time when you can express yourself more readily, and getting paid for it is harder.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little what happened to the music business too. It's like, it's so easy to make music. Anyone can make it on their computer now that it's just the market is flooded with music. It's easy for us to access it for free with like Spotify. Do you make a living as a musician? And I think if you can answer that question, you could probably then start to apply it to the business of film because I think they're very similar. It's like, now that the tools are in everyone's hands, you don't need the label to release your album. You don't need the studio to release your movie. Well,
unfortunately, though, for screenwriters, they can't appear live and sell merch.
That's how musicians had figured it out.
Although maybe once somebody should try it, it might work.
I always said that you should make a movie and then go on tour with it.
Yeah.
And you just like try to do sold out audiences. Like, I guess you do kind of, I think the guy who made The Room kind of did that after it became a phenomenon in LA. Then he started touring with it and appeared in cities to show it.
Yeah. But I guess we could agree that's a unique phenomenon. It's not likely to be. Yeah.
It's unique. And I still doubt he made his money back because I think that movie cost him $6 million.
I mean, from what I read, he did. It's been playing for 10 years or something?
I don't know. But how many sold out audiences do you need to like recoup $6 million? It's probably a lot.
I don't know, but I feel like, you know, like everything else, he's got a brand at this point. So, you know.
Yeah. And he probably made all kinds of deals, you know.
He'll do a beer commercial at some point where he makes fun of himself.
DVDs and sponsorships.
Right. And T-shirts.
You know, I mean, I can't remember how I first saw The Room, but I think it was a DVD. I think that's how I first saw it. I'm pretty sure.
I mean, look, I have an adult son and he's seen that movie like 10 times. So I think it's in the black at this point.
Yeah, it's got to be probably.
And Ulrich was telling me he made another movie.
Yeah, he had a movie at Sundance this last year. I read. I hadn't seen it or anything. But yeah, apparently he's now actually still making movies and, you know, getting a critical acclaim for them too, which is kind of crazy.
So the key is you either make an amazing movie or you make a total disaster of a movie.
Yeah.
If you make anything in between, you're not going to make your money back.
Yeah. I went to a screening of the Franco movie, and he was there. They introduced him, and he's iconic, right? It was like, oh, that's so weird. Yeah. He's here. He exists. You know?
I don't want to dwell too much on the past, but I would love to hear, like, what was it like when you first started out? Like, how did the business work, and how many screenplays did you write that didn't get produced? Like, because I always heard stories, yeah, about like working screenwriters that just didn't get a lot of credits. Mm-hmm. And even like on your IMDb page, there's gaps in your resume from like 1997 mm-hmm. to 2001, and then 2001 mm-hmm. to 2011. Like, what was happening mm-hmm. during those years?
You know, a lot of near misses. And there was, for instance, a lot of it was taken up with a script called Press Your Luck. And I was supposed to direct it. And we were in pre-production twice with two different studios. And just various calamities happened. And, you know, you blink your eye and there's 2 or 3 years gone. Where, you know, it, for most of those years, I expected to be making that movie, and it never happened. And then there's times when, yeah, you're doing rewrites and this and that. And to this day, I have tons of stuff that I still love and I wish I could get made. Although I think the business has changed a lot at this point, where it seems unlikely, but they were original screenplays and stuff.
Are those things that you own that you could sell to somebody else, or are they owned by studios?
Both, yeah. Or what happens is I had a script which was, the subject matter was very similar to Vinyl, that HBO
uh-huh.
series about
right.
sort of 70s rock and roll. And again, I got very far with that. It was actually supposed to be HBO. They bought the feature script but wanted me to expand it to a two-night movie event or something like that. And I was in pre-production on that one and it fell through. And now I mentioned that one because Vinyl was made. Now it will never be made, you know. It's like, and because Vinyl failed,
right
there, you know, it's a combination of things. It's like life, you know, you just have to sort of plug along. And I remember hearing that when I was young, and you thought, you know, the people you know about are like, well, what's he talking about? Wes Anderson makes a movie every 2 years. Woody Allen makes a movie every year. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah,
and, but I do think mentioning those two people is, that's probably the lesson I wish I had learned earlier, which is, my idol was always Billy Wilder, and I love the way he could work in any genre, and he could do a thriller, and he could do a comedy, and he could do a farce, and that's the wrong model if you want to make it today. I think you need to have a brand. I really do. I think you need to be known for doing a certain thing the way Woody or Wes or any of these people are, and that's, I think that's the key if you want to make a lot of movies, is to have a voice that's, you know, instantly recognizable.
Mm-hmm. And when you started out, you don't feel like you gave yourself a strong brand? You tried to do everything?
Yeah. I mean, I was more influenced by sort of, you know, the Billy Wilders and the Mike Nichols, you know, people who you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, he's known, you know, look at the range of Mike Nichols, from Angels in America to The Birdcage.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
There's no, so it's, this is not a good time to be that kind of a writer or director. I don't think it's better to have your specialty and to really, develop it into your signature.
Yeah. If you were to go back and do it all over again, what kind of brand image would you build up for yourself?
I think this pilot that I just sold has the voice that I really like, which is that it's a drama, but it's very, has a lot of sort of dry wit, and it's a drama with comedy. I like the tone of it. I think it feels like me.
Yeah. Is it similar at all to your first novel?
This pilot? No,
yeah.
No, actually. And I
can, so you say even your novel wasn't in your voice.
Oh, you're talking about the voice.
The voice.
Yes, I would say so. And also the novel I'm writing now.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you went from writing a novel, writing screenplays. At what point did you decide, I want to direct?
You know, sort of the second I saw what it was really all about, I was like, oh, I see. This is what you got to try to do.
How many years into your screenwriting career was this that you had that kind of light bulb moment? Like, this would be cool.
Oh, maybe like 2 years. I don't know.
Oh, so pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, one of my early experiences, because we had the same agent, was, you know, Bob Zemeckis was doing Romancing the Stone, and it was Christmas time, and my agent said, you know, and Bob Zemeckis was not huge at that point. He'd had two really good movies that hadn't quite made it. I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars. And he said, you know, one of my clients, his name is Bob Zemeckis. And I said, I know Bob's. I mean, I know his. I love Used Cars. It was one of my favorite movies. He said, well, great. They need a little rewrite. They're doing a reshoot. And so that was really fun because it got what I wrote was shot like a week later. And then the movie came out like a couple of weeks after that. And it was a big deal.
That's
so,
almost like television.
Yeah. And that actually was probably a destructive experience because that was very early. And I was like, well, this is easy. What's the big deal?
Right.
Anyway. But Bob, who ended up producing, you know, The Public Eye, which I directed, he said right away, he said, you know, the way you write, you should be directing, because he noticed that I sort of wrote in shots, whereas some screenwriters maybe have a paragraph of description or something. I do kind of visualize the movie and transcribe it. And he said that to me, and I think it put a idea in my head that, yeah, I should be doing that. So
it's awesome that you're able to figure out a way to do it. Like, so even though you had the idea that you wanted to do it, though, how do you make that a reality? Like, how do you get people to take you seriously as a director if you're just a writer?
Well, because I had strong allies. Bill Murray and Bob Zemeckis, they both really believed in me. So that's exactly why. It's because of them.
And did you have to do a short film or like prove yourself some way before you get the chance? Or they're like, no, just go ahead, give it a shot.
Yeah, it was the latter. When I knew I was going to make Quick Change, I decided to take a directing course at UCLA in the extension course. Yeah. And I mean, it was really bizarre because it's like the teacher was like, and why are you here? And it's like, well, and why are you here? Because I'm doing a major studio movie in a month. But
I need to learn quickly.
But
that's great.
This guy, his name was Ron. I can't remember his last name. But he had this kind of brilliant technique of teaching directing, I thought, which was, it was a very... You wouldn't even call it a studio. It was just a room. And he had a video camera on a, I think it was on a dolly. And that was it in terms of equipment and a boom mic. So here's how his class went. You had to find a piece of material that was 3 minutes long. You couldn't write it yourself. You had to find, you had to go to the library wherever they had screenplays and find a scene from a movie, a real movie. And you had to cast it on your own. You had to get the costumes on your own. You had to do whatever had to be done on your own. You had exactly 1 hour to shoot it. You know, like it was literally on a stopwatch. No matter what calamity befell, you had 1 hour to shoot it. And then you had to take that footage and edit it.
Wow.
And, so you had your week, and if it wasn't your week, then you were wielding the boom or, you know, using the camera, whatever. Everybody had a little job.
Was there like 10 people in that class or something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And when I tell you that this class was really great because it was exactly what it was like to make a movie for Warner Brothers. It was the same thing. It was the time pressure, and you got to figure it out. Because there's no choice. It was a really effective class, I thought.
That sounds great. What scene did you choose?
I had a scene from The Last Detail, you know, the movie with Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. Randy Quaid is a prisoner, very young Randy Quaid, who has to be taken. They're all. Have you seen it? It's a great movie.
I've never seen that, no.
Randy Quaid is a... They're all in the Navy, and he's committed some petty crime. He's a, you know, big... lugubrious guy and kind of a simple guy, and he they have to transport him, Jack Nicholson and his partner, from whatever base he's on to a stockade by train. And they realize, you know, along the way that he's like a virgin and is nothing, you know, and they kind of give him a good time and then they turn him over. It's a very poignant movie.
Sounds great.
And yeah, you should watch it. Yeah, so I did a scene from that, and a guy I knew who was not a well-known actor played the Nicholson part. It was David Caruso.
I was just going to, yeah, I was just going to ask, job. Like, yeah, did you, that's, yeah. That's great.
And yeah, it's just somebody I knew from around town.
So you just knew David and you asked him to come in to do the scene with you?
Yeah.
Was that kind of how everyone casts their actors, or did you guys do casting sessions?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the people were actors in the class, frankly. So, of course, they knew a lot of, it's L.A., so.
Yeah. right, it's L.A.
Yeah.
There's plenty of actors. You just walk into a restaurant, talk to your waiter.
Yeah.
So you said that because Robert Zemeckis and Bill Murray were championing you, you got a directing mm-hmm. job?
Because I liked my writing and I'd worked with both of them.
Yeah. When did you work with Bill Murray before Quick Change?
Well, Bill had sort of blew up so big after Ghostbusters that he left town. You know how he's such an iconoclastic figure. And yeah. So he... rather than deal with it, which I think was very smart, because at that point you're just a cash cow for people. He moved his family to Paris and he spent his time. He went to the Sorbonne and studied French literature, and then he went to the Cinémathèque every day because he wanted to learn about movies. And he did this for a long time. And we were both with CAA at the time, and they were freaking out because they had, you know, I guess sort of the biggest comedy actor,
the biggest comedy star of the 80s.
And he was AWOL, so they coaxed him back and got and they said they want him to meet with some writers to see about developing some material, and he sort of reluctantly agreed. And I think they kind of handpicked people who they thought were, you know, maybe a little more low key. Well, you know what I mean? Like not a used car salesman.
Right. They didn't want somebody that was super flashy.
As not to freak him out. Right. Yeah. And so
you were one of these writers.
I was one of them. Yeah. And he was staying at a hotel, Bel Air Hotel. And I remember he came out to the lobby and you could see he was nervous. This was definitely a guy, you know, re-entering show business after having withdrawn.
So when he went to Paris, he did nothing. Like, so no. This was like right after Ghostbusters, you said?
Yeah.
So how many years did he disappear for?
You'd have to look at IMDb, I'm going to say two years.
I never even knew this story.
Yeah. So he said, I have a convertible I rented. Do you want to take a drive around? So I had actually one of the most amazing days of my life. He had this like Miata or something, you know, nothing fancy. And it was like a great blind date. We just kept talking and driving and talking and driving and talking and driving. And at the end of it, he said, well, you know, if you're ever in New York, give me a call. And I'm like, sure, right. I'm going to call Bill Murray. So,
hey, Bill, let's hang out.
And then the next day, I just happened to be going to Santa Fe, New Mexico, with my young son and my then wife. And so we were sort of out all day doing whatever you do. And when I got back to the hotel, this was pre-cell phone, you know, like 1980, whatever. There was just like, and when you used to stay at a hotel, they used to hand you messages on slips because people used to call all the time. On the hard line. That's how it used to work. You guys probably don't remember. But anyway. So there were like 100 of these slips from CAA saying, please call immediately. You must call. And this is somewhat pertinent to the story. I'm 6'4". So I called CAA and I said, what's up? And they said, well, you know, Bill Murray said he'd like to get together with the tall, intelligent writer. And we think that might be you.
They just deduced it from his
description. Yeah, from my height. Yeah, yeah. So, I had pitched a story to him. And then, so we set that up at Universal. And that was not made, but he loved it. And then... and we did Quick Change.
So this is probably what, like 87 maybe or 88 or something like that.
Yeah.
I did the research just now. It looks like it was roughly, it's kind of hard to tell because like the way that movies come out, but based off of my knowledge of what timelines must look like, it was probably like 3 to 4 years that he was gone roughly.
Right. Wow. And
that's a lot.
Yeah. And it's a lot when you're at the height of your fame.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of what Dave Chappelle did when he got so popular and he just disappeared.
Yeah.
But I feel like he was gone for much longer than 5 years.
Oh, yeah. A lot longer. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe 5 years just feels longer, you know.
No, it was longer. He definitely... By the way, have you seen his Netflix special?
Yeah, I saw one of them at least.
Particularly the one on the small venue. I mean, he's... fantastic. He hasn't lost anything in
intervening. He's really funny.
I have to ask you about The Name of the Rose, because I love that movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's so good. But there's like four writers credited on it. Like, at what point were you involved in it? And like, did you work with all those writers, or did you just do a draft and then they...
No. The... you know, that book is enormous. It's like 1,200 pages.
Is it that long? And I've never read it.
Yeah, I think
so. Is it good?
Yeah. And it is. You know, the Umberto Eco, who wrote it, it's very slow going at first. And I read an interview with him where he said the first 100 pages are the admission charge, because I purposely made them as dense as possible.
Oh, that's funny.
And only the people who managed to get through it would be rewarded with the entertaining parts. But... somehow it was a huge bestseller, you know, international bestseller, as they say. And so at the point I came on, the director was friend Jean-Jacques Annaud, and he had worked with Gerard Brock, who's probably the most eminent French screenwriter. He's dead now, I think, but he did a ton of Polanski movies, among other things. If you look him up, he has amazing credits. But it was to be an English-speaking movie, and so what he had done, which was enormous, like backbreaking work, Gerard Brock, was to not write a script, but to write kind of this prose document, which had been translated, which kind of broke down the structure of the novel and put it into a form that was manageable for a movie. So I was given that, and I did read the book too. And from that, I'd say I wrote the script. But then after that, it was interesting, because at the time I did it, Fox was financing it, and they said that they wanted the English to sound American, not English.
Right.
And so that's how I wrote it. And then later, when I was doing Quick Change and they were filming it, it became an independent financier, I think French, who said, I want it to sound English, not American. And that's when they brought in Birkin, who's an Englishman, to, you know, if this, I will say, and he did a great job, but if it were this was not a under the aegis of the Writers Guild, because it was a foreign production.
Oh, okay.
And there's a real protocol in place where I don't think there would have been four writers.
Because if this was under the Guild, how many writers would they elect? Yeah. Don't they?
I think it would have been maybe me and Brock. I don't know, but that's how that happened.
So when someone like Andrew Birkin comes in to rewrite the dialogue, does he also mess with anything else, or is he really just going to focus on the dialogue, especially when it's not part of not in the Guild, so it doesn't change his credit on it?
I frankly don't remember. You know, I was involved with Bill and all that, I don't even remember how much changed or didn't change.
Okay.
But it's not like they said your mandate is to change the words, and if you see an improvement in the plot, you're not allowed to do it. I mean, I'm sure, you know, whatever he could bring to the party, he did.
It's pretty fascinating, though, to like have all these people touch like one piece of material, because like then at the end, who takes ownership? Like, do you feel ownership of that screenplay at all, or is it just now just it's a collaborative thing?
You know, I think a job like that, I once had this shrink who said you have to sometimes you're doing art and sometimes you're doing craft. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I'm sure any of the people who work on the Marvel movies or the Star Wars movies or whatever, I mean, that, you know, Star Wars is George Lucas. This is their craftsmen working in this. You know, it's like when you read about the studios at the Renaissance artists, you know, that's like 16 people worked on the Sistine Chapel ceiling, but they were all under the
right. They don't get credited for it.
Michelangelo. Yeah. So it's a version of that, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
An original screenplay, I feel differently about, you know. I feel like, no, that really is mine. And when I first understood, one of the reasons I probably wanted to be a director, when I really understood how it works in terms of directors versus writers and who gets credit, is, I wrote that movie, Someone to Watch Over Me, that Ridley Scott directed. And the genesis of that movie was, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's kind of an old-fashioned idea about a rich socialite in Manhattan who witnesses a murder, and a working-class detective from Queens is assigned to protect her, and, you know, romance ensues. But the the way I got the idea from that is I was in a cab leaving Manhattan for JFK. And if you look to the left, there was this, you know, glittering Manhattan landscape. And if you look to the right, there was Queens and, you know, these semi-detached houses. And totally, the whole idea of that movie came from geography. That's what it was about to me, the, you know, the proximity of these two worlds.
Mm, interesting.
And every review that came out kind of gave Ridley credit for the geography of New York.
You know, yeah, like, you're like, hey, yeah. Wait a second.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the story may be old-fashioned, but Ridley Scott brilliantly illuminates the disparity between the worlds of Manhattan and, you know, as if he had found this this screenplay that had some plot but no context, when right. for me the whole thing was about the context. So right. I thought, well, probably better to be a director.
That's so funny. But, yeah.
From that point of view.
You're like, wait a second, that was me. I did that.
Yeah, the director takes all the credit in the end. But so good or bad.
Well, I don't know if he takes it, but he's given it.
Yeah, sorry. Right, given right. all the credit, good or bad.
I have a question that kind of goes backwards a little bit. I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. So, like, when you started writing professionally in Los Angeles, how long did it take before your first movie got made? Like, how many scripts did you write before The Name of the Rose got produced?
Okay. What year was The Name of the Rose? Like, 80?
It was released in 86.
86, yeah.
86. Okay, so I feel like probably 3 or 4 years.
Wow. And how many scripts did you write in that time? Do you know?
Many. And I was paid for a lot of them. Wow. You know,
yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to get at is that, like, yeah, you know,
that's the difference now, you know. Yeah,
well, your life as a professional writer might start and then you don't actually get a published movie or a movie that's made for many years later, mm-hmm. you know. And I feel mm-hmm. like that still Absolutely. Happens. I mean, I still hear about that. I mean, not that I'm a, you know, Hollywood screenwriter.
Yeah, we just talked to J.D. Dillard, who spent 2 years like pitching movies and nothing got produced.
He didn't get paid for anything, really. Or maybe one. I think he said he got paid for one pitch
that he sold The Bad Robot. And then, and then he went off and just made his own film.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I'm sort of a dinosaur in that sense. I wish I had that skill. You have to be a little bit entrepreneurial now and wrangle your own movie, I think, you know. And I do think there is sort of like infrastructure is too formal a word, but I do know people who do that all the time, and they're people who work in movies love to work. Actors love to work, and set designers love to work. Everybody wants to work, so they can, you know, they can put together a movie where people are, I mean, virtually volunteers. You can do it. But I think now the bigger problem is that just, you know, there's so many entries at Sundance or at these festivals. Right. That's almost the harder part, is to get it seen. It's definitely a new world, and I'm not the best person to ask about it.
Right.
Do you know how many features are submitted to Sundance every year, Howard?
2,000?
4,000.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. That's a lot of human effort.
Can you believe that there's 4,000 new movies being made every year by independent people?
Yeah, it's
insane.
I mean, a producer that I know, actually through my young son's baseball team, brought me an article, and he said, "Don't you think this would be a great indie?" And I said, "Absolutely, but I don't know that anybody would see it. Why don't you try and do it as a TV series for HBO or something? You know, it just seems like a more plausible way to make a living."
Yeah, but you need an agent to get into pitch to like an HBO or Netflix, right?
Right, but you can spec that script,
right?
Right. Gotcha. But I mean, my friends tell me that, like, for the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, I'll have my friends who aren't in the business or anything, but they'll be like, "Ulrich, you know what you should do? You should make a Netflix show. You know what, Ulrich, you should do?
Right.
You should make a Netflix original movie." And I'm like,
this
that would
just
be great.
Happened to me yesterday. Somebody was, I was funny. Talking to them about how, like, yeah, you know, it's really hard to get things made and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, "You know what you should do? You should just make a show. Like, Netflix is just buying stuff, like, out of nowhere. Just, like, go make something."
Right.
Not that easy.
Exactly. The other thing I wanted to ask about was, so, you know, you told us this whole Bill Murray story, and this is probably roughly what, like 86, we deduced roughly when this is happening, when you met Bill Murray and he came back and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. 87.
Maybe. So, but then it's like 3 years until Quick Change comes out. Like, was that whole time being spent like rewriting the script and developing and working on putting the project together, or were you doing other things at that time?
No. What happened was Bill said he was going to make it, and then there was a lot of pressure on him to do the... he came back and he did Scrooge while I was doing it, and so that took some time. And then, while I was writing it, and then I was supposed to be next, but they sort of forced him to make Ghostbusters 2. And in the meantime, I was working with Zemeckis, and I had spec'd a script, which has never been made, which is a very funny script, actually, called The Wedding Contract. And and you know, Bill, it's sometimes he dilatory, you know, he stalls, he, you know. So when I sent Bob this script, he said, okay. And he had a lot of power at that point, Universal. He said, let's shoot for July 6th start date. And I said, okay, I got to tell Bill because, you know, we have this thing, which ostensibly we're going to make, but he's been dragging his feet. So, and then the second I called him and said, I'm going to do this thing with Zemeckis. This has never happened to me before. I got like an hour later, somebody knocked on the door and handed me a check from Bill. And so by saying I was going to do this other movie, that catalyzed an instant commitment. That's how it happened.
And it was a check directly from Bill to you?
Yeah, he had financed everything. Oh, there was no studio. Wow. That was a very unusual situation. We were well into pre-production with still no studio. Bill was just bankrolling it. We had Jason Roberts. We had Gina Davis. We had Randy Quaid. We had permits, this and that. And then Bill's then agent, Mike Ovitz, said, at a certain point, you're going to have to get a studio involved. And then we did. So, but he was just writing checks.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, I just watched that movie last night. I don't know if I said that on air, but it's funny like how many really well-known actors now who probably weren't well-known at the time are in that. Like Stanley Tucci pops up, Tony Shalhoub pops up. Mm-hmm. Even Phil Hartman, who probably wasn't that famous at that time, has a little small role, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was kind of really fun to watch that movie. And then also like... I read this article about it beforehand that was talking about the different side of New York that you get to see in that movie. And it was just fun to like, you know, I had just gone to New York this last spring. So getting to just see these different parts that some I had been to, some I hadn't been to, and be like, oh man, this is really cool. You know, and it's a little bit different than like the regular standard New York you see in every other movie.
Yeah. Well, last spring I was contracted by the Metrograph and they wanted to screen it, a 35 millimeter print. And there was a Q&A and, you know, so obviously there's a lot of sort of hipsters in that crowd and stuff. And they all the neighborhoods that we had shot in Brooklyn
are all gentrified now, right?
They were picked because they were so dangerous and decayed. And they're all, you can't, you know, they're all totally gentrified now.
Yeah.
So that other New York that we shot in is somewhat banished.
It doesn't exist anymore.
But one of the interesting things about that was that the producer of the movie was Robert Greenhut, who at that time had produced all of Woody Allen's movies, something like 20 or even more in a row. And so Woody did not shoot in the summer. All his movies had to have that overcast sky, so he always shot in the fall and winter. So we had his crew that summer. And basically, you know, they loved it because they were always shooting on the Upper East Side, the West Village, on the Upper West Side, basically. And now here they were in these crazy neighborhoods. And they for them, it was kind of a, you know, kind of a break from the routine.
Great. It's interesting that you were able to share directing credit with Bill Murray on that movie, because I remember there being like a big thing with the DGA about directors sharing credits when... Robert Rodriguez wanted to share it with Frank Miller.
Frank Miller,
So did they give you,
It's become more, you see it a lot more now, but at that time it was a big deal there. We had to go to the top floor of the DGA where they have this conference room that has, it was like gladiatorial. It has this big, this giant oblong marble or something desk. And people arrayed around it, and the middle of it was hollow, as if you could be thrown to the lions if you fucked up or something. But,
that's funny.
But they, you know, I look, movie stars just get shit that the rest of us don't get. They were so charmed by Bill. But at one point, the best part was there was a very venerable director on that panel or whatever, the committee, named Stanley Kramer. Who, again, look him up, amazing credits, and but his stock in trade was very earnest, liberal message movies. I know he did the Defiant ones, and again, look it up. Somebody look it up. But you'll see, he's a very impressive guy, but very earnest. That's sort of his hallmark. And he was old at that time, and he said, "You boys seem like very sincere fellas, and I'm going to go along with this, but may I tell you, I fear for you in my soul. I fear for you for that day on the set when one of you wants to use a 75 millimeter lens and the other one wants to use a 50. And he said this, I mean, it wasn't a bit like, or anything.
Oh, God, I mean, what would happen if...
Yeah, yeah. So when we were shooting it, I mean, Bill and I had talked about the movie so much before we got there that it was unlikely we were going to have any... We spent every day together for like 2 years, you know, so...
Yeah.
But, which I think is true of most of these directing teams, but if we had even the slightest disagreement, we would look at each other and say, I think we're in a 75-50 situation.
And then who would prevail in that situation?
It wasn't even like that. First of all, there's enough time to, you can do it both ways. Yeah. If, you know what I mean? It's like, so.
So you guys had to go to the DGA and talk to them before you went to shoot the movie because you wanted to share credit?
Oh, yeah. We had to get a special dispensation. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. How do they, that's so funny. I thought you would maybe have to talk to them afterwards so they could like kind of deliberate and figure out who actually deserves the directing credit.
No, you had to figure it out ahead of time. There are reasons for that. I mean, I'm making fun, but a couple years before that, there was like a Sylvester Stallone movie where he kind of hated the director, and midway through he announced he was the director,
right.
And they wanted to make sure it wasn't a case like that where
Bill Murray was coming in.
He's throwing his weight around and intimidating me.
Right.
And that's, I mean, the guilds are great. You know, we were just talking about the screenwriting credits. In the old studio days, they had something called the writer-in-law, which was like the head of the studio. His daughter had just married a sort of ne'er-do-well. And they'd say, okay, give him a writing credit, you know, so that he would have some kind of income and respectability. So the guilds do serve a purpose.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, they protect their members mm-hmm. in good ways. But yeah, sometimes it can get out of hand, the bureaucracy of it.
Yeah, but I'm very grateful.
So how many co-directing credits were there before there? Like a handful, maybe? Or was it like...
Well, put it to you this way. The bar was so high that the Coen brothers couldn't even go.
Oh, right.
Do you remember their early movies? It was...
One was a director, one was a producer.
Joel was the director. Yeah. It was always Joel. That seemed to be... But then once... I mean, in a way, I guess we did a service because we may have created the precedent where it's even possible. So... Hey, the Coen brothers owe me.
Well, now it's just a thing. I mean, you know, the biggest movie in the world right now, not even arguably, it just is directed by two people. So, you know, the Avengers, the Russo brothers. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. It happens a lot with brothers.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you and Bill talk about directing another movie together?
No, because he didn't like it as much as I did. He's a more spontaneous person and a lot of directing... A lot of his prep, you know.
But you guys worked together again. You guys did Larger Than Life together.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and A Man Who Knew Too Little.
Yeah, right. But I've read interviews with him where he says he's going to do it, but I don't know. He's so spontaneous, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it takes a lot to get a project off the ground and be with it every step of the way, you know, and it takes years and years and years. And you're probably not as many years for someone like Bill Murray who has the money and the fame to back it up. But, you know, still, it's like a long process.
No, it's surprising how, particularly now, there's just so much rigmarole and, you know, it's so many barriers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To, because they don't know how to release movies is the way they used to. They had the market. They had the people. Now all the, like, the grown-ups are all home watching Netflix. So.
Yeah, yeah. It's changed a lot.
Yeah.
Well, how did your movies do in the box office? Did they make money?
No, not particularly. I mean, a lot of them get really popular after. Obviously, Romancing the Stone was a big hit, but I didn't have a credit on that. But people knew, you know, they want to know that you've... And actually, Name of the Rose was, for a while, it was it was the highest box office of any movie in Europe, including Star Wars.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, weirdly. Because here it was okay, but there it was huge. And actually, at the time, I had a French wife, and my in-laws thought I was like jerking because
it was just. Nah, that's funny.
But, I mean, Quick Change is immensely popular now. I mean, I run into people who know the dialogue, you know. And it's always showing up on, you know, 10 greatest heist films of all time. And it's always, here's the wild card, you know.
Yeah, it's fun. It was a really cool, like, you know, the opening, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but the first act is really great and you don't know where it's going, which I think is one of the best parts of movies is where you're like, you know, how are they going to get, what's the rest of this movie going to be? You know, what's going to happen, you know, because it's kind of, you leave it really... It's like, if you haven't seen the trailer, it's like, you really don't know what's going on here, you know, from the moment that, like, you just start with this clown in the bank and then it's like, what's happening? Now what's going to happen?
Yeah, I think that was part of the challenge of the marketing. It's funny. I saw a Q&A with Jordan Peele about the marketing of Get Out. And he said the studio was like, we got to give away the twist. And he said, you can't, you know. So it's kind of that when there's a twist, it's hard to know how to do it.
Yeah.
Obviously, they got away with it because they didn't give it away.
I'm always shocked when I, like, I've seen Cabin in the Woods is, like, I love that movie. And I'm kind of shocked that, or how, I guess not shocked, but just, it's such a hard movie to market because so much of it is based on that twist. Because everything up until that twist is just a very typical, straightforward horror movie. And it's very generic and bland. But the twist is what makes that movie special. So it's actually, if you see the trailer, I think they almost give too much away because I think it's actually more fun just to go into that movie not knowing anything. So it's hard when you have a movie like that where it is so dependent on the twist to how do you market
it? The interesting thing about when we, you know, because the twist when they, I'm assuming everybody has seen the movie by now, but maybe not, but when they come out of the bank and Bill has got that weird nerdy wig and stuff, people were not catching on. They didn't realize it was him.
Oh, really?
For some reason. He was, and the clown. So we had to, there's this kind of like weirdly expositional thing where you see Bill's, you know, sort of gloved clown hand setting down the phone and saying to Gina, are you ready?
Yeah.
We had to telegraph it in some way because they weren't getting it.
That's right. The title of the movie is Quick Change.
But to me, it's hilarious because I was thinking last night when I was watching it that, oh, this works so well because you know who Bill Murray is. Mm-hmm. Like, if you didn't know what Bill Murray looked like, then it would be harder to make the connection. But since you instantly, you know that Bill Murray's the star of the movie, you know that he's the clown, and then you know what he looks like when he comes out in that get up.
But they didn't.
Funny.
Because the recruited screenings.
But you'd think even at that time they would, but like now as like someone like Bill Murray's a legend.
Right.
I mean, there's probably nobody who wouldn't recognize that now. But back then, even then, it seems funny that they didn't get it.
No, I know. It's interesting. There was this, the recruited screenings, you would hear this kind of murmur like as people were slowly figuring it out.
Huh.
But it kind of ruined it because people were figuring out a different time.
But that's
kind of
fun though too, right? To like have it like be that thing where people are catching on at different moments and it's, you know, they're catching up to the movie, you know?
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, when you're screening a comedy and that's not what you want. People like murmuring. You want, and then when we did The Fix, then he came out and they were roaring. You know, that's what you want.
Okay. That's what you want. You want the roaring laughter.
Exactly.
I guess I'm coming from like the sci-fi thriller, you know, horror background. So murmurs are sometimes good. You know, it's like,
what did he say?
No, you don't want that. That's funny. Yeah. I have some questions about directing and like what it's like to direct a big Hollywood movie because you know, we've only ever done our own little tiny little baby projects, you know,
but like I said, it's all the same. That's why I said the extension course was just like directing Quick Change. It felt the same. It's the same process. You know, you've got your script, you could do your master, you figure out what your coverage is. It's the same.
Do you feel like you're under the gun when you're directing these big movies? Like, were you like, do you have like, if you didn't make your day, you would get in trouble? Or do you feel like you always have a little bit more time if you need it?
Well, first of all, I'm a good preparer, but I'll tell you a story that, yes, I'll tell you exactly. I think I know what you mean. When we did The Public Eye for Universal, which is a small movie, you know, but it's about a tabloid photographer in the 1940s based on Ouija. I don't know if you know Ouija, the famous, who, you know, and Joe Pesci plays this sort of shabby little man who goes around New York with this giant camera taking pictures of murders and lovers making out in the shadows. And it's, you know, it's a certain kind of photography that Ouija exemplifies, but others were doing in that era. And they sold it to tabloids, car crashes, you know. And it was filmed almost entirely at night because he was a very nocturnal character. When you're line producers planning a movie, typically the first day or two or three, they're not going to do a huge crowd scene. They're going to do a quieter scene so, you know, the crew can get up to speed and everything before you start doing the more ambitious scenes. So there's a very poignant scene of Joe Pesci, and he's at an all-night diner, and it's kind of sort of sad prostitute is talking to him, but it's the mood is exactly loneliness. That's what the scene is about. And we did that, I'd say day one or day two. And I got a panicked call from the studio saying, what the hell are you doing? This is a movie. Put some extras in. Where's the vitality? You know,
and they're already questioning it.
And Sue Baden-Powell, the producer, said, you know what, I'm going to shake up the schedule. I would never do this because it's not the right thing to do, but I'm going to put, you know, a crowd scene tomorrow. You know, since she had to go to a great deal, get through hoops, just so that they could get dailies that would say, this is more like it. This is a movie, you know, so things like that do happen. Obviously, things like that don't happen when you're more established. But
yeah,
that was only my second movie. And they were freaked out that I didn't understand that movies had to have extras.
They want to make sure the train doesn't get off the rails.
Yeah,
that's funny.
Yeah.
You have to have extras in a movie or it's not a real movie,
which is kind of,
I don't think it's necessarily
true. I mean,
in
the context of the movie, that there's, you know, it's the dailies are one thing, but the you know, the continuity of the movie is completely different. So obviously there've been a lot of activity in this movie before you got to that scene.
Right.
But to them, it's like, is the whole movie going to be like
That's
this?
That's so funny. You think that they would have a better understanding of things as executives.
I know, but they panic. Yeah, it's a lot at risk.
Yeah. Let's see.
I wanted to ask, did the box office, not success, but box office, I guess, reports for your movies, like, hurt your career at all? Were there times where people are just like, yeah, we don't want to work with this guy because his movies don't make money?
It's not like that. But Bob Zemeckis explained it to me perfectly because his first two movies didn't perform. And he got a letter from Michael Eisner, who is the head of Disney. And he'd made neither of these movies for Disney, basically telling him people like him should leave town.
Wow.
And then he ended up... After Back to the Future, then Disney greenlit Roger Rabbit.
Right.
And then they ended up, you know, working together. But
they're like, we loved used cars.
Yeah. Yeah. So Bob said to me, here's how it is. In Hollywood, they're like a primitive tribe who believe in good luck talisman and bad luck talisman. And if you have a hit, they believe that your good luck will rub off on them. And if you have a failure, they believe the same. So... The my former agent, who's now actually Bob's producing partner, you know, if the movie didn't do well, he'd say, okay, it's okay. You're in movie prison for a couple of months. They'll forget, you know, and it's true. Then you'll write something they like and they'll take a chance again. But
just a couple months? That's doable.
Well,
do people go into movie prison for years?
Oh, yeah. Well, there are people who have done, you know, high priced bombs that are so notorious they never work again. I mean, there's a few of those stories, but But again, I think this is old Hollywood. I don't know how it is now anyway.
Well, I'm sure Josh Trank is in movie jail.
Who's that? Yeah.
He got fired
from Star Wars.
Yeah, he's like notoriously in the shit with the studios because he just like made a stink on what? Fantastic Four?
Fantastic Four,
and also Star Wars.
And pissed off a bunch of people on that project.
Well, they also let go Miller and Lord on Solo, right. Which I think those guys are amazingly talented, and I think they would have gotten.
Yeah, they're definitely not in movie jail, but maybe right now they're just not in Disney's favor.
Well, mm-hmm. I think it was clear that they just had a different style of filmmaking that wasn't conducive to making a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, but I bet they're wondering maybe it wasn't such a bad idea after all.
I don't know. I mean, everything I read was that Ron Howard reshot 70% of the movie, doing like very classic
that's a lot.
Hollywood techniques or just the way that he approached the set, like, two takes, super buttoned down, no improv, just boom, 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 let's get through it, And apparently that's what I'm reading is like how they got that movie done on time with the director change. Mm-hmm. But, again, it was also like went crazy over budget because of the reshoots. So
it's funny that you say like it's like the Hollywood production style, like two takes. I was just hanging out with an independent filmmaker and she was complaining that all she could get was two takes because she was always crunched for time. But I guess you're right. Probably in a lot of cases, that's all you need. Especially when you're working with like super professional people.
I remember once I was talking to Rick Moranis. Do you know who he is? He was in SCTV and he
in Ghostbusters, Little Shop of Horrors.
And then he and his partner from SCTV they did direct a movie, some Canadian subject. But because they were hot at that moment, and the studio head said he was sitting at a glass coffee table at a party with his head of a studio, and said, "Did you ever think of directing?" He said, "I don't know. I don't know all that much about the camera and stuff." And the studio head said, "It's so simple. Anybody could do it. Here's how it works: put the camera about 5 feet away." That's your master. You put the camera on you, that's your single. You put the camera on me, that's my single. Then you put the camera under this glass coffee table up at the two of us and you got your art shot. And then you move on.
If only it were that easy.
Yeah, I mean, you can make a movie like that, but it gets to be pretty boring after a while. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, Timothy, I have a few questions, like kind of more about what's going on now. Do you have anything else about like, other stuff that you want to go over first?
I mean, before we wrap it up, I just want to kind of go through some like craft things, like, how Howard writes. So why don't you ask your questions first?
So, you mentioned before that you're writing TV pilots and TV show stuff and that you just sold a pilot. But what's the plan now? Are you just doing TV things? Are you trying to get back into the directing chair on one of these pilots or the TV shows? Like, could you become a showrunner on a show? Is that like a path for you?
Yeah. The thing is, if you create a show, you're the equivalent of the director of a movie. I'm not working on staff or anything. I'm trying to create a show and get it on the air, and then direct, not direct. It's I see why now, just doing the pilot, why you might direct once in a while, but there's so much writing involved. You don't really have that much time to do anything else. But that is my goal because that's the kind of material I do. And I just don't see the same outlet for it in features.
So the pilot you just sold, is that one that might go to series that you're just kind of waiting to hear back from now?
Yeah. I mean, it's just happened. So, but it would be a cable or a streaming series, and I don't want to talk about it too much.
You don't want to jinx it. You don't want to talk. Mm-hmm. It's not, nothing's concrete yet, but that's really exciting. Congratulations.
Right. Thanks.
And we hope to hear more about it. I mean, it's funny because I feel like the streaming TV shows are some of the best things that I've seen in the last like 5 years, but then some of the Netflix original things are, I don't know. I feel like when you don't give any feedback or you don't get involved at all as a studio, then sometimes things can get off the rails.
Mm. Well, I just think the volume of stuff they do is a challenge.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just like, you can just tell that like with certain projects that it's like, they just, they're like, oh yeah, that's great. Here's the money. Mm. Go do it. We trust you and deliver a product, you know? And that like, there was no studio notes. There was no feedback. There was no nothing. Cause it's just like,
right. I just don't think they, but I don't think anybody would have the resources to supervise right. that many,
right. Yeah.
That many sense. Productions. They're limitless. It seems if you drive around LA, they have these billboards and it seems like half the billboards in LA are, you know, Netflix. Right. And premieres July 9th, premieres right. July 14th.
Every just, week.
It's right. as though this.
And it's not just 2 hours of stuff. It's like,
yeah.
you
yeah.
know, 12 to 20 hours of a series.
I think there's a new mm-hmm. Netflix original every week in some form, like whether it's a show yeah. or a movie or a show and a movie every week. It's pretty crazy. Yeah. But yeah. I don't know. I mean, but then I've seen some things that are amazing too. So I think the system is working. But yeah, it's just a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. We hope to hear more about this stuff when it happens. Maybe we can have you back on when your show is, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd love it. Well, I'd love mainly to have my show on, but I'd love to talk about it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. No, this is that. I love the idea that, you know, I've been freelance my whole life. And in the movie business, it's like you go from, you have to reinvent the wheel every time. And the idea that a show could be something you did for a period of years really sounds appealing, you know. And
yeah.
Go deeper and deeper into the characters. And I would love
especially
that.
Especially if you could get to make them at the level that the shows are being made now, you know? Like, it's mm-hmm. not just like a sitcom yeah. or, you know, something that they're rushing through. It's like they make these shows like they're each episode's a mini movie, basically, you know, with like the best production value. Like, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. you could tell they took a lot of time putting them together, like Westworld, you know, like. I mean, that's a masterpiece each episode, you know?
Right. The light bulb went off for me, I didn't get into it then, but then I realized what was happening was, I don't know if you guys remember The Sopranos, but I consider that, you know, in the top five anything in my lifetime. I mean, I thought it was just so amazing and still do. And, there was a period in The Sopranos where Tony and Carmela were going to get a divorce. And the subject was divorce. And simultaneously, there was a movie in the theaters with George Clooney. I even think the Coen brothers wrote it about divorce. I'm trying to think of what it was called. Do you guys remember this?
Is it The Decemberists? I didn't see it.
No, it was like, you know, Irreconcilable. Not one of those like generic.
Oh.
But
sure.
the Tony and Carmela divorce stuff was devastating. It was so real. It was so vivid. And then the Hollywood the movie version was so
right.
silly because they, you know, and I was like, wow, you really can do stuff in TV that they're not doing in movies now. What was the name of that?
Yeah. And you can explore it in different ways. Movies are
something cruelty. Something
I think it's probably because
Intolerable Cruelty. Intolerable Cruelty.
Huh? No, I remember I think that might have something. Yeah.
I think you have more acts with TV, right? Like with a movie, it's usually an hour and a half to 2 hours. So you only can fit in three acts.
Yeah.
So you can have more movements, more things happen in a TV show that it's probably.
Well, one of the pilots I did was with Dick Wolf, who's an amazing guy. I mean, you know, you don't think about him because he's almost, it's like he's like a, it's like Campbell's Soup or something at this point, but he's actually a brilliant guy. And he said, you know, for a feature, you have to have 100 good minutes. For a TV show, you'd have to have 100 good hours. So that's challenging.
Yeah, that is challenging. How do you do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you do it.
So I'm curious to know, like, coming from a background writing a novel, like, how do you approach your screenplays? How do you crack your stories? And what's your process to go from, like, an original idea to a finished screenplay?
Well, again, that's evolved because of the marketplace. In the old days, you could go in with a solid kind of paragraph of a pitch, and they would pay you, and you could work it out later. Now, particularly in TV, they have this thing, it's called an outline, which is actually a contractual part of the whole, it's a step you have to do, which is outlined is not even covered. It's like a beat sheet. You really have to work out everything. And so because I've been working in TV, I've gotten used to doing it that way. The script, the pilot I sold, I spec'd it, which I prefer. I prefer to work out a lot of stuff in the writing. But if you want to get paid to write anything at this point, you have to really work it all out.
So if you could do it, though, without, if you didn't...
Very detailed.
If you had to just do it on your own and you didn't have to worry about what other people needed from you, would you outline or would you just start writing?
I would know sort of who the characters were and have some landmark scenes, but I would not necessarily outline the way I had to learn to do.
Yeah, not get super detailed with
it. And
that.
I know I was unusual in that because I did come from a prose background, but I know people who go to film school have always done it that way. They always pinned up the note cards. I know Zemeckis and Gale, I always had, you know, every scene blocked out. So I think that's probably more common than not among film school people.
And how many drafts do you write before you start showing it to people?
There used to be such a thing as a draft when you used a typewriter, but the thing is evolving so constantly on right. a computer that, you know, I'd say usually you have a draft, maybe you show it to a friend or two who's a writer, get their input, and then turn it over to the producer. This is a big bone of contention in the Writers Guild, who has some notes, and then you give it to the studio or the network. The bone of contention is how much writing should you do for the producer before you give it? Is that like an extra step you're not being paid for? But the reality is that everybody has the same goal, which is to get the movie made or the show on the air. So you tend to do, if the producer has 10 or 12 great ideas or criticisms that you agree with, you're not going to say, well, I'm not doing that because I want to get paid for that. You know, you're going to do it. So,
and then last question is, when you're writing, do you have a daily writing schedule or do you just write when you feel like it?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I've got a family and stuff. That's, you can't do it that way. So I'm very, organized. And also, my best time is in the morning, sort of 9 to noon. But you have to stick around the keyboard all day just in case the right thing mm-hmm. comes. I once read an interview with Warren Beatty, who I really think is a great filmmaker. It was actually on Howard Stern, and Howard Stern said, "Do you write all day?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "The problem is, you know, you really only come up with one good idea a day, but you never know when it's going to come. So you just have to be there all day waiting for it." And I think that's actually quite true. I mean, you know, a lot of it is just sort of fussing over stuff you did a week ago or this and that, and waiting for that little burst that you get where you move forward and
right.
have something
so
good.
Your best time, you say, is from 9 to noon, but that doesn't mean you just, that's the only time you write. You'll actually be available all day if new ideas come.
Yeah. I'll usually take a longish break in the middle of the day, and then it gets kind of good again toward the end of the day. But I feel like you're gonna, if your time gets, available time gets less. Like when I was doing the pilot last year and there were a lot of other things to do beside writing, casting and stuff like that. I got a lot more done in a lot less time because I had no choice.
Yeah.
You know,
I think there's a lot of people listening to the show that just, they don't have the luxury of spending a whole day writing. They, you know, we have full-time jobs.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
you
so
don't
I was
have
wondering
to.
Like if you, you know, only, if yeah. for like, for instance, me, like, I tend to only be able to find like 1 hour a day that I can write while I'm working. And that's like first thing in the morning. Have you ever had to work that way where all you have is an hour? That's the only time you can write. And has that worked for you?
Well, certainly like when you're directing a movie and location or whatever, and things happen all the time. I mean, you get, oh God, we lost that location. It can't be at the railroad station. Can you figure out something else? You know, and you're directing the movie and you have a 6 a.m. call. You gotta figure out how to do it, you know, the hour before you go to bed or get up an hour early. Yeah, I've certainly had to do that. And I know, for instance, Somerset Maugham, you know, the novelist, he didn't supposedly have a great imagination. He actually had to be in the world to know what to write about. And I read a biography of him where he did everything from sort of 8 to 10 a.m. so he could spend the rest of the day living. And he was enormously productive, prolific, you know.
Yeah.
So it can be done. It's just focus and concentration.
All right, cool. That's awesome. That's it. That's the end of my questions. Alric, you got anything else?
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it's just, I mean, I think we could ask questions forever, but, you know, we don't want to make this a 4-hour episode, so I think we should call it, but it's been really great to talk to you and hear about your career and, you know, what life is like in the Hollywood system, you know, because I think most of our listeners are not in the Hollywood system, you know, and are like kind of just either getting started or, you know, trying to figure out how to make a movie or even how to write a movie, you know.
Right. And like I say, I'm probably not the most instructive person because I'm really recounting, you know, old stories of how it used to be.
Yeah. But that's what's funny is it's almost like we're all dreaming about the old stories that we've heard. But to hear that, like, oh, that doesn't exist anymore is like, it's good to hear. Mm. Because, yeah, I think for some reason, I think you grow up hearing stories about how it works and that that just kind of gets ingrained in your head and you just kind of assume that it's always going to be that way. But the industry is constantly changing. And especially,
yeah, I mean, just in the 3 or so years I've done the TV thing, everything has changed. Like, so they used to. They said, you know, the first thing you have to do is get a studio, you know, whether it's NBC Studios or Warner Brothers or Fox, you have to get a studio. And then once you have a studio, because they're going to pay for the production of the pilot and of the series, then you have to get a network. But if you don't get a network, the studio is not going to make it. Well, now they're saying, we're not so sure you want to get a studio because Netflix and HBO really prefer to, you know, own these outright. And, you know, so a lot of this stuff in like money stuff that has nothing to do with your process, but it affects
the creativity is always there, but the way that it's kind of turned business wise, is always changing. Yeah. What the need is for.
So I guess my last question then is like, you know, if you're talking to, imagine you're talking to like a young filmmaker who's, you know, just getting started, you know, trying to figure out what to do, you know, and like, let's say they want to direct and maybe write, like, what would you suggest for them to do?
Well, if they want to write, they should write. I mean, that's, you know, they want to do a movie. If they want to do a movie, I do think at this point you have to do it on your own to get your foot in the door or something, you know, like the guy who directed the Childish Gambino music video. I'm sure he can write his ticket.
Because
I think you do have to direct something. And as we've discussed, that's doable nowadays. I mean, a short something that at least you can show to an agent and say, oh my God, he's got something or she's got something.
Yeah. Everything that we're getting from other people is that shorts aren't enough anymore. Mm-hmm. That you make the short to prove to yourself that you can make a movie, and then you have to make a feature to prove to someone else that you can actually make a movie.
Like I said, I don't know. I don't know anything. But like, just to give you another example is when I was doing this thing with Dick Wolf 3 years ago, he said, well, why don't you put that character in the pilot? And I said, I don't want to get to him. Well, you got to get to him because otherwise we're not going to be able to shoot the pilot. They won't know about the character. And I said, well, can I write like isn't it called a Bible or a sort of a series where you describe the series? He goes, nobody reads those anymore. They're completely passé. Wow. Well, now with the one I have now, I wrote one anyway. And the studio said, oh my God, this Bible's fantastic. You know, and at this point, that's more important than the script.
That's so funny.
And I said, really? And they said, yes, it's all turned around in the last 2 or 3 years. So everything changes.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Wow. Well, I don't know. I think the bottom line is do it. If you want to do it, do it.
Do it. Yeah.
Whatever that's it true. Is. Yeah. Write, direct, you know.
Yep.
Yeah. Act. Agreed.
All right. So Howard, we have 5 last questions. We just want an answer from you that is like one sentence each. So this will go really quick. Lightning round.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So these are questions that we ask every filmmaker that's come on the podcast. So just so we can kind of compare how people answer them. So, and this will be interesting. The first one for you, like as a screenwriter, let's say that your screenplay is 100% of what you want from your film. But then when you go and direct it, David Fincher says you're doing pretty good if you can get 70% of that vision on screen. Do you agree with that?
Who am I to disagree with David Fincher?
That's the best one yet. Yeah. Who am I to disagree with David Fincher?
That's funny.
So I agree.
What's the thing you struggle with the most as a filmmaker or a writer? Either one.
You mean creatively?
It could be anything. Creatively, you know, it could be getting a movie, whatever it is, you know, getting a movie made, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, the fun part is the creative part, the hard part, the impossible part is the business part. There's just no way to, you're not in control of that at all. You know, it's your luck and kismet, and I've never figured it out how to ace that aspect. And some people have. Some people are really good at it.
So you think you already answered this one. If you could travel back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be? And earlier you said it would be to kind of create a brand image for yourself.
Essentially become an auteur, to have a brand, to be associated with something so that you'll have your own audience. And you can continue to work.
Nice. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
To keep working. To keep making, you know, some kind of film narrative, television or
movies.
Yeah,
that's a good goal. Last one. Is making movies hard? And if so, why do you do it?
Well, it's hard, but it's not hard the way working in a coal mine is hard. I mean, it's not really hard. It's very gratifying. It's fun. And if you're a storyteller, you just want and need to tell stories, and it's as good a medium as any. And the physical process of making a film, if you're lucky enough to be doing it, there's nothing more exhilarating.
Amen to that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Awesome. Howard, thank you so much. We took up so much of your time, but this was so much fun.
Oh, that's okay.
Awesome.
That was cool. It was fun. It really was. This is my first podcast. Anne has done something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ah, welcome to the podcast world.
Oh, really? Wow. First podcast.
My son has done like a million of them. You know, he's an actor. He does, you know,
so. Yeah. Oh, man. They're so much fun. I kept telling Anne she has to start a podcast. Like, it's going to change her life.
Yeah. And you have a sponsor, right?
Yeah. We have. Actually, this episode is going to be sponsored by Seed and Spark. So it'll be our first sponsored episode from a new sponsor.
Oh, cool.
Oh.
Yeah. Nice.
Well, that's cool.
That's great.
So, yeah, it's fun. It's really cool. Is there a place where our listeners can like find out more about you or reach out and say hello? Do you have a Twitter account?
No, I don't have any. I don't have a website or anything.
So like incognito. That. This is it, guys.
Yeah.
I love
it.
I love it.
Exactly. All right. Well, it is time for my favorite segment, the game. What is the game, you ask? Oh, thank you for asking. It is a handmade homespun segment created by our producer, Eric Toms, or he sets forth a hypothetical indie film quandary, quagmire, problem, scenario, and we have to wiggle our way through it and try to figure out what we would do if we were put in that scenario. Alric's never heard this, and I'm going to read it right now. All right, Alric, you've just started production on your next feature. Pre-production has gone smoothly, and you've assembled a terrific group of cast and crew members. However, one of your leads is a method actor, and just a few days into production, their on-set technique is really rubbing everyone the wrong way. They're not putting anyone in danger, and the work you're getting from them is top-notch, but everyone, yourself included, cannot imagine spending the next 2.5 weeks with this person on set. People are starting to complain, and one crew member has quit. You're running out of excuses for this person's behavior. Do you, A, fire the actor and hope that their replacement will deliver as good a performance? B, just grin and bear it for the next couple of weeks and hope that the actor's antics don't cause any of the other cast or crew members to quit? C, rewrite the part to be much smaller and try to shoot the actor out way ahead of schedule? D, other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
I have a series of meetings. I will have a meeting with the crew. Well, first, a meeting with my department heads to discuss the problem and the situation and kind of come up with the best solution. Once we decide what that is, which is most likely going to be a number of things, but like we'll talk to the team and see what everyone else is what everyone is comfortable with and see how everyone's feeling about it, and like make sure that this problem isn't just being perceived by us as a big issue and like, or one or two people, but it's actually something that's affecting the whole group, and just make sure that it's really a whole team dynamic that it's affecting. And then basically have the same meeting with the cast and see how the cast feels about it. And so like once we know more information and we say, okay, like let's say everyone does agree that this person is causing huge problems and this cannot go on this way, then I would have a meeting with the actor. And I would talk to the actor directly and I'd be like, look, I love what you're doing. I love the work that you're putting in, but this method that you're doing is very disruptive to the rest of the team. What can I do to help you keep your method, but also allow you to function with the rest of the team in a productive, manageable way? And just see how that goes. And if like they're like a maniac and like won't like either keep themselves isolated from the crew, which I'm sure like some people would probably be fine to do, like just like, hey, like I'm gonna stay in my green room, I'm gonna have my meals alone or whatever, like I'll only come to set for my scenes, like that could be a solution if they are into that. Or, you know, maybe they just tone it down when they're on set and just like not have those outbursts, like just keep it in internal, like internalize the method, you know, because I know I don't want to ask them to not do the thing that they need to be a good actor, but I can also ask them just to treat other people like basically like let's say like they're Andy Kaufman is like who they're being or whatever, like maybe you can't control Andy Kaufman, but like any whoever it is, like you can go to that person, that version of that person, and be like, look, you have to treat other people with respect when you're on the set. Like you can't just do XYZ like whatever you want. Like you need, like this is a part of a society, this is a team, like you can't just be this way. And you know, just hope that works. But I agree, this is a very tricky situation. It's a very tough answer. But I would communicate really clearly with my whole team and be very open about it, and then come to a solution that everyone is happy with. And, you know, that what that solution is would depend on the answers from the cast and the crew after we had these meetings. But I do think if it does come back, as Eric says in this question, like it is not a workable situation, something has to change, then I would talk to the actor and say, like, what can we do to improve the situation? Like, what can I do to help you? And what is going to allow you to give us the great performance that I love and also not make everyone miserable at the same time?
Yeah. I'm having a hard time picturing what is an example of this behavior. It's like, maybe you mentioned Andy Kaufman. It's like, it could be someone who doesn't shower because they're in method acting. It could be someone who's really mean. It could be someone, you know, it says that no one got hurt. Like none of the cast and crew got in danger. I think what you're suggesting is a fantastic way to go about it. I almost think another way is just to go to the actor first and just say, you know, here are the boundaries. Like we're, you know, if cast and crew starts dropping, you know, we're prioritizing them over your behavior. I think that's one way. I think the second way is, yeah, it's just establish where are the lines. Because I like the idea of allowing them to stay in character for whatever this character is. I think that's interesting. But then warning them that the cast and the crew is turning against them at this moment, and that if it fuels their performance, so be it. But then we're going to have, they're going to experience a tenseness on set that is not going to be enjoyable for them, right? So it's just giving them a heads up on how everyone else is feeling. But part of me just thinks we should grin and bear it, because I assume that this actor was cast for a reason. I don't see any point in recasting the actor. If they're mean and they're rude and abusive, then that does mean that people are getting hurt on set. They're not being put in danger, but it's impacting everyone's mood and the temperature of the creative collaboration. But if we all band together against this actor and the actor gets off on that, that's an interesting solution to me too. Like maybe they're trying to start shit because they feed off of the negativity that they receive by rebelling and being an asshole on set. So I'm not against using their bizarre antics to our advantage either. I am just really concerned about everyone other than them, because they're choosing to participate in kind of like weird manipulative behavior. I'm not very pro method, I guess, but I wouldn't want to curb them.
Yeah, I like what you said about going to the actor first, because you don't want to make them feel like you're dealing, like everyone's in on something that they're not in on, you know, because that's like not a good feeling, especially for your star. Like I'm assuming this is a movie star type person.
That's what I'm guessing, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I do think like, maybe it's a conversation with them first. And then, you know, if it doesn't improve, then it's conversations with everyone else. And I think when you talk to the actors, I don't know. I think my first instinct was like, talk to everybody else but that actor together. But I think maybe that's wrong. Maybe you just have to talk to the whole cast together as a cast and just be like very open about the situation.
But I think this actor probably, again, gets off on whatever behavior they're doing and they know it's sparking something, right? It's you don't act like Abraham Lincoln for 2 weeks without knowing that it's going to upset other people. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely heard stories about this with the Master, with Joaquin Phoenix, like where he was, you know, completely in character and just acting like a maniac and like, you know, just sort of. Yeah, it being really like, I don't know, unsettling and like just odd, but like you just like you understand what they're doing, so like you just don't let it you don't take it personally and you don't let it upset you, you know?
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I don't know. I've never worked on a movie where an actor was doing that necessarily, and I never had that happen in any of the movies I've made necessarily, so it's I don't exactly know what I would do, but I think I don't know. I think having the conversations seems like the best way to go about it.
Yeah, it's tough. I have no idea what I would do. I just kind of like said things out loud that came to my brain. But if you have a suggestion or a thought or response to this game question, you could send us an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Breimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.